Shalom.
Peace to you, Shalom.
Baruchim Habaim, welcome. Welcome to Awakening Torah, Musar, Mindfulness. I am Rabbi Chasya Uriel Steinbauer, the founder and director of HaMachon LeKedusha, the amazing Institute for Holiness, Kehilat Musar, Mindfulness, a center based in Israel here, but open on Zoom and throughout the world of practitioners of Musar mindfulness, where we join as taking refuge in community together to live this path, the practice of Musar from Judaism, what some call tikkun hamidot, repairing of our soul traits, but it's much more than that, and mindfulness as based from Theravada Buddhism and the Dharma, this path of unifying and learning from these ancient wisdom traditions where we can be on this path towards holiness. And I'm delighted that you've joined us today on Tuesday, November 7th at 12:34 here in Israel, Haaretz. Normally we meet Motzei Shabbat, Saturday night, or the latest on Sunday. But as you know, we are at war here in Israel, and I could not join you sooner to offer this week's awakening. So, what is it that we do at Awakening? For those of you who are new, it is a weekly public offering by my institute to learn the Hebrew Bible, the Torah portion, the weekly Torah portion, what we call parasha, from the lens of Musar mindfulness, so that we can learn from God and our ancestors what is it that we are supposed to use and take from the Torah in order to not only survive, but be on this path to be the best person that we can be in service of God and others. So before we begin, we always jump in with our kavanot, our intentions for today's session. And before I do that, I will briefly just say that this session is sponsored by one of my students, a fellow Musar mindfulness practitioner, Jillian May Holiday. Thank you for sponsoring this session. If you would like to sponsor in the future, either in honor of someone or in memory of someone, please reach out and be in touch at our website at kehilatmusar.com or reach out to me personally via email. So thank you, Jillian, for sponsoring today's session. So this whole year is trying to be a wise response, an appropriate response to the genocide that happened to our people on October 7th in Israel, done by Palestinians, Hamas, and also some Palestinian citizens, Gazan citizens, a mixture of both, who crossed over into Israel as an act of war and committed horrible genocide against our people. So we are responding with a call to frame this teaching around grief and loss, how to heal together, how to be present for one another, how to take refuge in God, in the traditions, in the past, and here in community. So let's begin with our kavanot, our intentions. So hopefully you can see the screen in front of you. For those of you who have vision or are watching by video, for those who you will join us by audio, either on podcasts or from the website in our blog section, you see before you that we have three kavanot, and I will read them also. We dedicate the teaching to this is a radical act of self-care, so that we can strengthen our own souls to be of benefit to others in the future. So much of this grief and loss is healing simultaneously individually, based on our own resources and temperament and personality and skills and the what we might have available to us. And it's also so that we can communally heal and respond and take care of one another. So we say before doing acts for others, which we see this as time of acting for others, to practice dedicated time to do this together. This is something I'm doing to strengthen my relationship to others so I can be a better conduit of God's good to others when they need me. We're also doing this to strengthen our relationship with the divine, what you might call God, Hashem, the creator, whatever. We're doing this to strengthen our relationship with the creator so we can be a better conduit of God's good to others when they need us. And obviously there's great need right now. There's great need personally. It's that threefold triangle I mentioned. We have to do the radical self-care. We care for others and our relationship with the divine. And it's all strengthening and supporting one another. If we lack in one of those areas, we're going to collapse. We're going to feel that. It's not going to be, I don't want to call it a complete healing because perhaps there's no such thing as complete healing. But there's going to be something lacking. Okay. So for those of you listening by audio, I've removed the intentions from the screen. And we are going to be covering the Torah portion from last Shabbat, which was on November 4th, 2023. And was also a Yud Dalet. Let's see here. Yes, Yud Dalet of Cheshvan, the Hebrew month of Cheshvan. Tav Shin Pei Dalet, 5784, the Hebrew year of the Hebrew calendar that we follow. So we were in Vayera, okay? This is the fourth Torah portion. It was Bereshit, Noach, Lech Lecha, and now Vayera. In the book of Bereshit, of Genesis. And first we're going to go through a summary of this, and then we're going to hone in on what I feel is most appropriate for where we are right now, what we need to get from this text. Okay, summary. Avraham, our ancestor, the first major patriarch of our tradition, he, after circumcising himself, being commanded by God to do so, he is sitting outside his tent at the height of the heat of the day around noon in desert climate. So try to visualize this, okay? An old man, just circumcised, sitting out of his tent at the height of the heat of the day. He sees three men walking in the distance. Nobody walks in the desert at the height of the sun of the day. This should already be a sign that something is happening. Three men come and he runs. He gets up and runs to invite them over for hospitality, for food, drinks. The guests in our tradition, we say, are actually angels. That becomes obvious through the dialogue that they know much more about him than he knows about them. And they tell Avraham and Sarah that Yitzhak, their son, will be born in the coming year. Okay. God then tells Avraham that Sodom and Amora are going to be destroyed because of the people's horrible behavior. The consequence for the behavior is that earth, society, God can no longer bear the burden of them, refuses to. The behavior is too horrible and sinful to bear, and it will be destroyed. Avraham pleads on Sodom's behalf. He pleads on the behalf of some people who have done horrible deeds. Okay, we will look at that in a minute. But there are not enough righteous people in the city to save it. If you haven't read the Torah portion, please do so. We'll get into what this all means. Lot, the nephew, cousin, depending on who you look at, of Avraham, Lot and his wife and his two daughters are essentially saved by two angels that are sent by God down there. They run away while Sodom and Amorah are being destroyed from fire in the sky. Unfortunately, his wife turns around to look back when she's actually commanded by one of the angels not to not to turn around, not to look back. And she turns around and looks back, and she becomes a pillar of salt. Yitzhak, who was born when Sarah is 90 years old and Abraham is 100, lots of miracles in this Torah portion. And Sarah sends Yishmael away. If you recall, Yishmael is the son of Abraham through Hagar, Sarah's maidservant, slave, if you will, who she had marry Abraham in order to produce a child for her. And that is Yishmael. Okay. God tests Abraham by commanding him to offer Yitzhak as a sacrifice. This is known as the Akedat Yitzhak. Lots of troubling things going on in this Torah portion. We'll try to touch on them. We can't cover everything, obviously. They travel for 3 days to the mountain that God shows Abraham. An angel calls out to Abraham at the last second, telling him not to harm Yitzhak at all. Okay. Just then he sees a ram in the bush by its thorns caught there, and the ram is offered in place of Yitzhak. And this is known as the binding of Yitzhak. Okay, so that's our summary. A key thing I want you to be awake to and pay attention, because we always want to focus on certain midot, certain soul traits is part of our practice. And I meant to point this out last week because it's starting to loom so strong for me, is how silence functions in all these Torah portions. Either someone is not balanced in silence, which we would also call wise speech. It could also be an intercontemplative silence, but let's leave it at wise speech. So we either have people who are too silent, right? Are unbalanced in this way, too much silence. They don't speak up when they should or when we wish that they should. An example of this is Noah, right? Noah listens to the command of God, builds the ark, does not argue on behalf of humanity, does not argue for repentance. Actually, that concept, repentance and teshuva, is not even in the Torah yet. Okay, that's not even here. There's behavior and consequences for behavior, what we might call the natural consequences of cause and effect, also known as karma in the Dharma. So Noah does not try to argue. Don't kill all of humanity, all of everything in the flood, in the rains that are coming. He doesn't do that. So it's too much silence, right? We might argue or not. Then we have people who have too little silence, right? Speaking up maybe when they shouldn't, taking up too much space. We might not see so much evidence of that right now. Okay, we'll point that out. But we want to pay attention to how silence functions. When does it arise? Who's silent? When? Why? What's the purpose of it? How does it serve? In particular, related to grief and loss and trauma, which is what we're dealing with here, we have our fight, flight, freeze, or fawn, which is part of the model of trauma, right? So some people fight right away. So that might be someone with speech doing that, whether it's appropriate or wise speech, we'll see. We have someone who fawns, who really tries to placate the person who might be causing harm or a difficult situation. So we'll witness that in this Torah portion when Avraham tries to argue on behalf of Sodom and Amorah. There's a point where he's really doing fawning behavior, trying to placate God and convince God not to do so. There's also flight, where the person either internally goes away in order to shut down during the trauma, or actually physically, there's flight, leaves physically. So we witness that again in the whole dialogue with God and argument. There's an outward fight of arguing, and then there's flight of pulling back and not arguing anymore or pushing it too much. And the last one is freeze, right? And it's where the person just goes silent. And maybe not a type of healthy, wholesome, appropriate silence. We might, a classic example of this is, which is debatable. Okay, I'm leaving it open to interpretation. But some people argue when Aharon, the brother of Moshe, loses his two sons. They are consumed by God because of their offering of strange fire, that he goes silent. But the verb there is actually not shtika, it's not silence. It's a form of udumama. I'm trying to think of how to translate it, like a stillness. So his might have been done with intention and kavanah. But sometimes there's freeze, that's something so overwhelming that you just can't respond at all. Now, in response, today is day 30 since the genocide of October 7th here in Israel. And all of us are going through all four of these: fighting, flight, freezing, fawning. You see the full range across the Jewish community and the non-Jewish community in response or reactivity to the genocide, and then the choices of Israel to respond to eliminate Hamas from the land area called Gaza. So, and the consequences of that, right, that come with it. So, difficult stuff. We're also going to pay attention to a concept of faith in God's justice, which is huge here. It's huge in this Torah portion. So let's move through this. Understand that these narratives given to us by our ancestors, entrusted to us, passed down for thousands of years, really can be a balm of understanding and direction, right? A path, even a path for us to navigate our trauma, navigate our reactivity to what has happened to us and continues to happen. So I went through last week and kind of a trajectory that we're witnessing in the Torah of personal trauma to familial trauma to community trauma to national trauma to worldwide, right? As I move through the examples. So for instance, Noah was traumatized, right? And his reactivity perhaps is even post-traumatic stress disorder when he consumes too much alcohol, passes out, doesn't even know what one of his sons does to him. So those are examples. So now we're moving to the classic example of Avraham. Avraham is an ancestor who clearly is more resilient than any of the men and women who preceded him. We witness a maturity. We witness a practice with intention. We witness somebody who has a moral compass that's developed, an awareness of the suffering and discomfort of others, a consideration of others that we don't witness, and asking, in some sense, a permission to choose the less evil path. What's an example of this? When he knows they're entering as gerim, as foreigners, into a foreign land, he says to his wife, I know how they operate here. I know how this is in the ancient Near East. They're going to see you. They're going to kidnap you. They're going to kill me as the husband. So we can lie and say I'm your brother and I live and you still get kidnapped. Unfortunately, there's no good path here for women in the ancient Near East and sometimes still in the the Middle East is this, as we all know. He asks for permission. He says, please consider that I might live, right? Choose this less evil path, even though it's still an evil path. Sometimes things are so bad that we have to choose which is the lesser evil, that we still have to respond. We don't have the privilege of not responding. That is the situation that is brought on to us. And that's what happened on October 7th. We have to respond, and we are. We have to have an appropriate response. We have to be able to pivot and constantly evaluate, is this still the best, wholesome, appropriate response, given that it is the lesser of evils, that we're still going to cause harm and suffering to others in our response to the genocide, of having to hold Hamas responsible. Okay, this is the same thing with Avraham. He is constantly awareness of this consideration. There's a moral ethic here, a compassionate one. Just and right is here. This is where we see these concepts very much so. I think I want to say one key thing about just and right here. if I can find my source, give me one second. Okay, so let's move into the first case, what we mean by just and right. So coming from one of our first texts, it's from the Jewish Publication Society, the JPS Torah Commentary on Genesis, page 132, where it talks about Abraham's dialogue with God concerning the welfare of others, total strangers, but not just total strangers, people who actually committed horrific, horrible acts that need to be held responsible. Okay? Similar situation. So Abraham displays an awareness of suffering and ability to respond beyond his own personal interests. Okay? And he shows himself to be a moral man, a compassionate person, right? He's really this paradigm of just and right that come to characterize what we are to aim for as his descendants. So he goes on to plead for the lives of people who have moral depravity. Really, for many of us, we would just write off. Okay, but he is showing us that you argue on behalf of those created in the image of likeness and the divine. So hard to say that those who are committing acts of evil are created in the image and the likeness of the divine. And he goes on to argue. And what is he arguing? God, you can't eliminate all the people down there for the behavior if you find 10 righteous people. In the end, God sending angels to witness on the ground, God always comes down to witness what's the actual behavior, teaching us that we must go down and witness. So important that everyone really analyze and look at and understand what happened, for instance, on October 7th, go down and witness, to understand that there was not even 10 righteous people left. And so what is the consequence? There could have been 9. There could have been 9 righteous, not even just innocent, not just babies or toddlers or children before adult age, because obviously they live there too. We're not even accounting for that. They talk about lesser evil. We're counting for adults. Couldn't even find 10 righteous adults. And we're not even talking about neutral, like the average human being who wouldn't be called righteous. Like he didn't say, if you can find 10 average human beings, or can you find 10 goblins who either are just regular human beings who are being oppressed by Hamas, or who are actually righteous and who are speaking up and against Hamas. Okay, this is not the argument. You couldn't even find 9 of them. Okay, so, I mean, 10 of them. So say there's 9. What's the lesser evil here? The horrible consequence that we have to live with. All will be eliminated in Sodom and Gomorrah, even if there's 9. So the consequence of responding in the most wise way, given the lesser evil, to people who commit great acts of moral depravity and evil, just horrible behavior, is that you have to respond and stop it. And that takes sometimes eliminating them. And then the sad consequence is that there will be those who are either neutral, like most of us, or who are righteous, who will die along that path. That's the horrible choice that one has to make and that we are making right now, right? The lesser evil, because you have to respond as God did. And so this is key here. So they have reached the limit of the ability of innocent, civilian, righteous, even a small amount of individuals to outweigh the accumulation of evil in the community. And the Torah is teaching that one must act. And so God acts and Abraham is the witness. And so we too are acting. And, you know, as usual with any of this, we'll live with the consequences that is faced. And There's nothing clean and easy about this. There's nothing where we can walk away with clean, pure hands. That's the tragedy of genocide and how victims of genocide are treated, that they have to respond and stop. And that leads to sometimes having to do things that completely rub against or go against our values. For instance, if a part of our path is not to cause harm and suffering, then we need to find the path that causes the least amount while still stopping the people who are causing harm and suffering on a global and international level, crossing borders into another country to cause harm and suffering. So let's go on here. Remember, I brought up responses in the Jewish community, even non-Jewish community, of freeze, flight, fawn, and fight. We see this across the spectrum right now. If those, for instance, on the maybe flight, fawn, or freeze side of calling for a ceasefire from Israel. Right. And that's a lot like Lot's wife when she runs and leaves from the trauma of Sodom and Gomorrah being destroyed. She's overwhelmed by the devastation. And it's what in for instance, a book known as The Wisdom of Solomon. This is a pre-Christian book that didn't actually make it in the Jewish canon. Where it says that back in an understanding of a pillar of salt, which came with it its own stories and mythology, that a pillar of salt signified the unbelieving soul. And so, in some ways, Lot's wife was, according to our ancestors passed down in stories, the unbelieving soul. Either she couldn't believe what was really happening. Right. So she's caught, she's locked in the past. She keeps looking back, locked in what's happening, and maybe even in the trauma, what's happening. She can't be here in the present moment, having to make an appropriate response to the trauma that's happening. Right. This unbelieving soul. I can't believe what's happening. I won't believe what's happening. I won't take the moral courage and responsibility to make a decision and have to live with those consequences. Rather, I just contract. I freeze. I fawn, right? I go into flight. So it is so important for us to recognize that the daughters of Lot in the story, and even Lot, are now going through their own trauma, perhaps even survival guilt, leaving. And surviving, right? Leaving the past, being in the present moment. And then you see the total fear of Lot's daughters in the storytelling that the whole world's been destroyed. And that they have the responsibility to make the wise decision to reproduce with their father by causing him to be under the influence of alcohol to be passed out, right? Talk about getting hands dirty. In order to have the long-term consequence of survival, but it's caught up in not the facts on the ground, not knowing that the whole world hasn't been destroyed, but are they able to leave in that moment and go investigate that? So without judgment towards them, it's more just a complete understanding that so many of us, with a lack of resources and full knowledge on the ground and seeing what's out there and available, will pivot only based on the narrative going on in our head and the limited knowledge that we have. Okay, so to just have a lot of compassion and understanding. So let's move on. And so much I could share with you here. It's really intense. We move into the narrative where again Sarah is kidnapped. By Avimelech, and Abraham is saved because he's told that he's the brother again, not the husband. And there's so much silence operating here, particularly from Avraham at first, where he just doesn't speak, perhaps out of fear. Again, we want to witness and pay close attention to how silence operates here. But there's really a knowledge of maltreatment of the ger of alien, the person who is either a refugee or a foreigner into the land. And that basically there's the kidnapping and trading of close female relatives. And this is in a desperate bid for physical safety of the male, of the patriarch. And we witness Avraham in the skills that he does have, how he can pivot or not. And there's lots of moral ambiguity here, right? For us, thousands of years later, with great privilege, sitting here can judge, can have judgment mind. We have to be very careful and watch that in our learning. Judgment mind towards Avraham, that he should have known better. He shouldn't have allowed this to happen. He should have taken the chance to be murdered to save her honor, even though she most likely still would have been kidnapped and raped. Now without the protection of a patriarch out there somewhere. And this is really the choosing of a lesser evil, okay? And it really shows us a painful reality to those in relationship with Hashem, with God, particularly in the Torah, that some of us may feel this very strongly today. That being in relationship with God, right, and following God's order, commandments, doesn't always bring moral clarity in the moment, doesn't always bring comfort, and doesn't always bring pleasure. And modernity, particularly in the West, is all about it being comfortable, it being completely morally clear, it being pleasant to be in relationship with the divine entity that we make up. Okay. And it demands that one's relationship with the divine entity feels good and right. It's a form of hedonism. And it's just not the God of the Torah, the God that is in a covenant with B'nai Israel, the children of Israel, with us. And this is hard for many moderns in Western society to accept and face, but it's so much the narrative that's passed down to our ancestors for us to wrestle with. Are we gonna be able to like make this easy and calm and walk away with clean hands? No. Life is not that way. It is full catastrophe living, to quote our teacher, Jon Kabat-Zinn. And so we want to be aware that, of course, we want to pivot as best we can with the amount of knowledge that we can gather, which obviously should be done in community, to hear from other sources, other witnesses. And it comes with humility, the balance anava, to know that we're going to make a decision and have to live with the consequences. And sometimes that's going to be a lesser evil. It's not going to be clean. There are going to have to be things that we're going to have to live with after making such decisions. And this is the place where our people, Israel, is right now. And so we want to just really practice a lot of self-compassion and awareness that this is the state that we're in. All right, let's move into a final analysis of this that I wanted to share with you. I think what's so important of why we take refuge in community, to be honest with you, is this: we have to be of support to one another. And in particular, to clarify our moral compass as much as possible. We see Avraham in the Torah portion saying, I didn't see any fear of God here, and I knew you were going to kidnap my wife and kill me if I didn't lie, right? Having to be really clear, knowing the truths of people and the harm that they want to cause. So Avraham had no...
He didn't lie to himself or even others of what he was witnessing in the land that he was staying, of how the people were and how they behaved. The same with Israel right now. We can turn and we can say, we know that Hamas and other terrorist groups and even some Palestinian Gazans with them in that moment and now in their lives are not operating by the same moral compass, if any, and that it's not acceptable and they're causing harm and suffering and we will not live by that. And so to be able to be clear as we can be and to support one another. And that's the only way through grief and loss and healing over time can we do is by doing, practicing part of the Dharma, which the Buddha taught as the first practice, which is seeing clearly. Seeing clearly what's before us. Not lying, not trying to gloss it over because it's too difficult to look at and face. Being very clear that we are not safe with these terror groups existing and surviving and operating as governments in the nation state right at border with us, that we must respond appropriate to them and eliminate them. This is very clear. It's clear seeing. It's not glossing it over. It's not calling it something else. We must support each other through this. So Avraham is told at the beginning, Lech Lecha. He has to cut himself off from his past, everything he knew, family, land, culture, everything. Lech Lecha. He's told again when he's going to take his beloved son, Yitzhak, Lech Lecha, go again. Go again and leave your future. Your future of having a son and descendants, cut off all of that. The man, talk about living in the present moment. He has no past. He can't have any past. He has no future in this commandment to go and slaughter his son. In the present moment, trying to pivot, trying to do what's responsible. This is a man that will follow God's order above all, which seems completely foreign to many of us. To acknowledge that, no need to push it away. Being able to answer honestly, if I had a call today, would I really listen to it? Would I follow God's order? This is the moral ambiguity that we have to wrestle with today, because we don't have God before us saying, Lech Lecha or Lech Lech, right? So I have such compassion for him, because could you imagine being, it's a practice, it's a spiritual practice to try to put your feet in his shoes or his sandals, how even to face such a thing, right? The child is only saved by divine intervention at the critical moment, just like Yishmael is only saved by divine intervention, given water at that moment, right? Both cases involve an angel calling from heaven to human beings. This is agonizing, right? And really, we witness someone, and in some cases, we have to question, like, is this the best role model for us in the sense that, we don't know how to apply this as a spiritual practice, as a path. Someone who really face test and has such obedience and loyalty. Right? Leave your land, leave your son, leave your homeland, your favored one. Leave your father's house. Take Yitzhak, your loved one. Look at the language very closely. They're exactly the same. So Avraham is such, he's a model of unbelievable humility, of someone compassionate, who is now evolved morality of just and right over time. We're witnessing, really showing this trajectory of maturity and the ability of the human being to practice and develop and become the best version of themselves. while still getting their hands dirty, that's still in that full catastrophe living, right? Still being able to pivot, still being able to have to live with the consequences of their behavior, that because of the society and what is put on some of us, just like a genocide, we have to be able to respond. And there's no rule book. There's no Torah handed down to us of, when you experience a genocide, this is how you are to behave. Perhaps it is up to our generation actually to write that rule book, to begin to pass that down to our ancestors, knowing that if the human being survives, there's always going to be evil that will behave this way, and that we have to be able to respond wisely with an appropriate response. So I want to close with just for our own practice to learn from Avraham's behavior, from all the verbs that are applied to him. For instance, when he sees the three men who end up being angels coming at midday after he just had surgery on his private organ, he sees, he gets up, he runs, he prostrates himself, he hastens, he fetches, he carries, he stands, he serves. Amazing. Amazing zerizut, amazing alacrity, amazing seeing what needs to be done, going up without any hesitancy and acting, and follow through. All three of the criteria balanced and shown to us, right? That can only be done with someone who is clear about their purpose and path, right? And then when he argues with God over Sodom, he goes through such pivoting, right? I'm dust and ashes. He demands, he argues, he claims, he musters all his inner resources. He draws near, and Rashi, as he teaches with the Hagashah, this drawing near, right? That you do it to join or battle. So this is the Avraham fighting, right? And then you do it to appease. This is the fawning that's going on, right? Then he prays, right? Which sometimes is like, for him, this kind of fleeing or freezing in the moment, recoiling, contraction and awe and fear of God. And we witness all of this. He is truly modeling for us, and the ancestors have passed this down to us for a reason, that he is modeling that we are to behave, that we are to act and respond, and that there's different ways that we're going to be responding in different moments, and we're to try all of them. This is part of the experiential path of this practice. We are to practice and try all of them so that we can respond as wisely and best as we can, given the situation, given the circumstances. So I'm going to close this teaching today and then move into our mindfulness meditation practice, which is very important today. So thank you for being with us through this. I think we're ready to move into our practice. Please assume one of the postures that's right for you, where you feel upright. You don't need to be sitting in a chair, but where you feel internally upright, full of dignity, because you are created in the image and likeness of the divine. That you should feel loved, seen, that you belong here. We're going to share this oxygen together in our sitting practice, taking refuge in the practice and the community right now. So you could be seated, you could be standing in a strong mountain pose, walking back and forth, or lying down on a bed with eyes open, please, to remain awake and alert. For those of us seated right now, I sit at the edge of the chair to remain upright, and really a sense of arriving. I invite you to close your eyes if you have vision.
If you do not feel safe with your eyes closed, then please just lower the gaze before you. We're going to begin with three deep cleansing breaths. So inhalation and exhalation. Inhalation and exhalation. On this final one, please raise your shoulders up. Inhalation and exhalation. Dropping the shoulders, inviting with full intention, Kavanaugh, that you be right here, body, soul, mind. I am here to sit and practice. I'm inviting myself fully here. I'm going to let go of any thoughts, ruminating over something in the past, planning for something in the future. I'm going to settle. Allow your breath to come to its own natural rhythm, just breathing in and breathing out, really inviting a sense of ease. Allowing yourself to just feel the weight of your sit bones, your feet on the ground. So grateful to be able to be here and have this time to fully settle and arrive. Noticing if anything's calling for your loving attention. Maybe there are strong emotions that are arising. Just simply acknowledge them as a friend who has shown up at the door, who's distressed. Just welcoming in as much as you can, asking yourself, can you be with this? Really coming at yourself with so much kindness, with gentleness. A real stilling the mind. So today I move through what we might call the shape of mindfulness practice. And there's a certain dimension to mindfulness, and then we're going to move through the four dimensions that will really assist us in our practice, and in particular our practice this year of moving with, toward, together, through the grief and loss from the genocide and the ongoing war, and our people who are captives, who have been kidnapped. Very important for us to move through and be aware what is the practice that is going to most nurture us and carry us through the difficulty of surviving this. So the first is stilling the mind. Right? Mindfulness has to be in the service of meditation. And it's a meditation that is more than just observing thoughts. It's more than learning to distance oneself from stimuli or our reactivity. It's more than finding relaxation. Mindfulness has something to do with stilling and calming the mind. It begins with self-soothing. So a real deep love for yourself, learning to become your own best friend. And it progresses to creating ease, calming, discerning the factors of the mind that are useful and appropriate to bring the mind to unification. This unifying process is called samatha in the Buddhist tradition.
and must be part of mindfulness. We need slowing down, stilling, deepening, unifying, calming, which our practice of Musar mindfulness values greatly. And so have these ancient traditions, particularly of the Dharma and Buddhism. So that is our first part of the practice, is stilling the mind, which I understand for the beginner and even for sometimes for advanced practitioners can feel daunting, can feel challenging. Instead, we feel like we're having monkey mind. So many thoughts, so many jumping around, so many emotions. So understand that this is a practice. We take one day at a time. And over time, there will be a stilling of the mind, an ability to be with without reacting, an ability to witness, which leads us to the second dimension of mindfulness, which is disidentification, which another way might be saying to be able to witness without identifying. It has to create disidentification, the possibility of stepping back, of gaining perspective, of moving out. This is so important on day 30 since the genocide of October 7th in Israel, that we over time learn to step back, gain perspective, move out. We move away from the stage and into the audience. We acknowledge what's happening, but that there's also something else that is capable of awareness of what's happening. This is indispensable to our practice. So as we are calming the mind and stilling the mind, even the body, see if you can begin to develop the witness, the disidentification. Noticing whatever is arising, whether it's thoughts, sensations in the body, or strong emotions, that you can just witness them. You can even name them with a naming technique. Hello, reactivity. Hello, fear. Hello, hot ball in my stomach. Whatever might be arising, you can gently name and know that this too shall pass. It is not fully you, if you at all. And the third dimension of mindfulness in our practice is what we call moving back in. Once we learn to disidentify, to just be a witness, we step back and gain perspective, then we gradually and humbly negotiate a path back into the intimacy with the process. Now, for many of us, we will not reach this stage until more time, more practice. We meet our angels and demons. This is a very personal journey. It involves our own personal makeup and psychology. It will unfold according to our skill set, our resources, our social location, our temperament, our socialization, our psychological makeup, our character. This investigation is the ability to courageously meet the parts of our makeup. And this is indispensable to our
meditation and mindfulness practice. What we do on the cushion also is what we do throughout the day with mindfulness. The practice doesn't end right here in this chair. There are no spiritual shortcuts through this terrain, this dimension. No spiritual bypass. We have to do our psychological homework. For us in Musar mindfulness, it'll be looking at what mi dot are imbalanced that we need to work on. What are the hindrances that keep arising for us habitually, that we keep heading down that same path and falling into that same hole instead of crossing the street? We must move through that when we are ready, when it is the wise choice. And the fourth dimension of mindfulness, and the final one, is called universal perspective. So much part of the self-compassion practice. Where we mindfully become aware of what's going on for us. We practice the mindfulness. And then we tap into the universality that everyone suffers. Everyone goes through pain. Everyone goes through loss. And there's our shared humanity. We are not alone in this. If anything, we're strengthened by this in refuge and community. And then practicing that deep self-compassion to heal ourselves, to carry ourselves through this day by day. So in our practice, universal perspective is necessary to understand our personal stuff, our imbalanced midot, of course. But it's very important to understand it in universal terms again. We can move outwards again and begin to understand what we have learned about ourselves and bigger concepts. Concepts that are not just personal and not just psychological. They extend beyond our own stories, beyond our own narrative. So for instance, for us in Israel here, and even among the Jewish people worldwide, when we are ready to move into this fourth dimension of mindfulness, and each of us will be at our own pace. There's no rule to follow that we're all supposed to be at the same place. When we are ready, we might start to see this shared humanity of others who have gone through genocide. We might share the humanity of how terrifying this was and is, and how others feel terrified. We might notice that we carry with us this transgenerational communal trauma, post-traumatic stress disorder for generations from so much genocide and kidnapping of the Jewish people over thousands and thousands of years, that we bring that story, that narrative with us, which of course was real. But we have to also live in the present moment and recognize the universal element to this, that this is a crime against humanity. Yes, it was done to the people of Israel, which are not only Jews. Peoples of all different walks of life were murdered on October 7th. But this is also a crime against humanity, what Hamas and some of the Palestinian Gazans have committed and continue to, holding on to the captives, the kidnapped. That this is something where we share this universally with others. And so when we're ready, we move through these dimensions of mindfulness as an ongoing daily practice, stilling the mind, disidentifying,
learning how to be a witness instead of caught up in the reactivity, moving back in and witnessing where our own imbalances, what we can practice and strengthen, what we can find to nourish us, and then moving into the universal perspective that we are not alone, that we share so much. Allowing ourselves some time in silent meditation. I will pull you out of the meditation when it is time. Ral Yeruchem Levowitz, the great Musar teacher Mashkiach from Belarus, over 150 years ago, if not more. He taught that the actions and behaviors of the righteous are like a building, and I'm going to apply that to all of us practitioners, that our actions and behaviors are like a building. And he goes on to teach, with each action, a righteous person is building a great edifice. We are building a great edifice with our daily behavior and practice. And so, for this reason, he teaches, the Torah tells us about each detail of Avraham's chesed, his loving kindness, that he did on behalf of the three men who ended up being angels, and arguing on behalf of the souls in Sodom and Amorah. We're going to war to save his cousin, nephew Lot, for working with God to save Sarah, for so much. And every moment was another stage in the building of a righteous person. And so I'll even argue, right, with Avraham, if we were to witness his house and every act of chesed building his edifice stronger and stronger, we would see cracks also on the walls, because he had to choose between two lesser evils. His hands were dirty, with blood on his hands. He also chose to hide that he was taking Yitzhak to offer as a sacrifice. He did not wake up and tell Sarah, as far as we know. There would be blemish in the edifice, but still he would be practicing and building. So we are to view ourselves as building a great person, a great edifice. Every detail of what you do is invested with meaning and importance. Every positive action you do is creating a great human being, created in the image and likeness of the divine. Keep this in mind, as every act of chesed, of metta, of loving kindness that you do, every movement you make is necessary part of this ongoing construction on this path. And don't wait for the end to appreciate what you are doing. Relish with us in the joy and the growth, even in the smallest acts of chesed that you do on a daily basis. We live in times of great moral ambiguity, where we must be clear on our moral compass. And if Avraham's main goal in life was to carry out the will of the Almighty, we attempt to do so too, knowing with great humility that we do not feel as clear sometimes as Avraham might have. Avraham was not focused on whether he personally enjoyed what he was doing, but he was always focused on what was the right thing to do, not that he was right. He was always focusing on what was right in God's eyes. This deep practice of his, this self-discipline, allowed him to do all that he could do, for instance, for these guests coming at high noon in the hot deserts after surgery, and wait on them even when he is recovering from surgery and in pain. Think to yourself, as we head on this yearly path of grief and loss and healing, what is your major criteria? What is the right thing to do right here and right now? And act with the enthusiasm that comes from that inner acceptance of the importance of doing the right thing. You may gently and slowly come out of your meditation practice when you are ready, offering yourself a deep bow to God and to your practice, to your community, to your teachers, to our ancestors. Thanking everyone for this amazing path and practice together. I thank you for practicing and arriving. Please do be in touch with comments and questions if you'd like to sponsor a session like Jillian May Holiday did today. Thank you again. And the last thing I will share in closing is we welcome a whole group, a whole congregation of new Jews. A student of mine, Alfa Cortez, and her beloved spouse have a congregation out in Arizona in the United States. And they have moved over their practice and time from Christianity to Messianic Judaism to converting to Judaism and have joined the Jewish people fully. If anything, I see this as a returning. It's a form of teshuva, but it's a returning to their people and the path. And it's, as far as we know, since over 2,000 years ago, have such a large number of people converted to Judaism together. It was the leaders and the congregation came together as one to join the Jewish people and to be on this path together. And we are so much stronger for it and blessed. It's a great day and a great news to really celebrate this on the 30th day after the genocide, that these new souls were there at Har Sinai, Mount Sinai, and have come forward 5784 Tafshin Pei Dalet in 2023 to fully say, Hineni, I'm here. I'm here to serve and to be a part of the Jewish people. So we are blessed today. Welcome. Welcome to your congregation. Welcome all of you. We reach to you with open arms and with joy. Thank you. Thank you to all of you for your practice today. And I will see you for Chaye Sarah, our next Torah portion. Please read it ahead of time. God willing, I will be able to join you Motzei Shabbat. God bless.